Asking someone where are you from can be really loaded because it can call into question whether or not someone belongs to where they are now. But so many Australians were born in another country. It's kind of what makes Australia what it is. Today on All the Best, we're asking where are you from because, to be honest, for many people, becoming Australian has been a really interesting experience. Dean grew up in Croatia, which used to be part of the former Yugoslavia. It's a region that has experienced war, ethnic tensions, and noise from a very small group of metal fans. Also, heads up, Dean likes to cuss.
So growing up in a socialist country is quite a different thing to growing up in the West. You are probably less aware of many, many things that people in the West take for granted. For example, I've never had Maccas until I was about 18. I wanted to grow my hair long, and that was quite outrageous. I used to actually get bashed by the local thugs a bit, and so they used to wait for me and beat the shit out of me, basically. So yeah, I did have a bit of an outcast period between, say, year 6 and year 8. But then in Yugoslavia, you change schools in year 8. That's pretty much where I actually found that there is a whole bunch of people like me, and we're all listening to metal, and it was all cool.
Was it metal music in particular that was the thing that set you apart?
It was totally outside of the mainstream. Like, Split has probably had about 200,000 people then. There was a metal dudes group. Probably we had about 20 people. There was about that many punks. And that was the underground scene in Split in 1985. Most communist socialist countries, the expectation is that you finish high school and you do army service. So in Dalmatia, which is the part of the country where I come from, going to army was always, it was like you're giving up your child. Like, mothers were crying. Any conversation that you had with anyone older would essentially end up being, you know, it's going to make you a man. I am a man. I don't need to be made a man. Maybe I had serious discipline problems. I wasn't fitting in, but I didn't want to be disciplined. I didn't want to be suddenly more responsible. Actually, I enjoyed being irresponsible. I enjoyed not giving a shit. Army was exactly the opposite of all that. A few days before I was actually due to leave, we had a haircutting party for me at my old girlfriend's place, and where I got actually everyone that was there to cut my hair. And I left like 3 or 4 like tiny plaits, but long and random. People were just going, chop, 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 you know, like chopping my hair just willy-nilly. There were bits like bald and not bald and then tufts and, you know, like it was just not pretty. When I get quite anxious, I break out in a rash, and in the lead up to actually leaving, I was quite anxious and not sleeping and so on. And I had, like, I cultivated this rash, and I thought, and it was really easily treated. Like, you just put some cream on and it goes away. But I thought, no, I'm going to actually leave that and put that one in the bank. And it was kind of up my arms and my hands. So yes, I rock up with my anxiety rash and 4 plaits on my half-shaved head. You go through like a medical, and they looked at me, what's that? And they put me straight to hospital. The tricky bit is that you can't actually openly rebel because they just put you to jail. Hunger strike was also out off the table. I spent those couple of days that I was in hospital going, what can I do? Eventually they released me, like my rash cleared up fairly quickly. I still had hair all over the shop. One of the officers that was sort of came about and just went, what are you doing here? What's wrong with your hair? Why are you not? And sort of sent me expressly to the barber. And so I took, they took me there and they just went. Rah, rah, rah. I sneakily ate a yogurt when no one was looking, but every day I would line up with 500 other recruits, trundle into the canteen, sit there, like pick the worst looking, stinkiest shit that they were serving so I could sit in front of it and not eat it.
What do you remember about the things you chose?
So I hate lamb. When there was lamb, when there was mutton, sweet. I would actually dry retch sitting in front of it. Or fish, and we were so far away from the sea, like it was probably 6-year-old frozen fish, and it stunk. And that was great because I could, you know, I could sit in front of it and not be tempted.
No one suspected that you were trying to go on a hunger strike.
Not at all. Because I just went through this process of going to the canteen, sitting there, you know, saying, I'm not hungry, I'm cool. There wasn't an issue. And then, like, I was also kind of trying to be annoying more than anything else. So every morning you had to line up, you know, stand straight, you know, like a classic army shit. Like every morning, you know, they line everyone up and then they inspect, you know, each new recruit. And I would have my hat wrong way around, or I would have my shoes left and right wrong. And so, you know, like if you can imagine, standing in this line of perfectly lined up soldiers and then there's two shoes, they're going wrong way around. The professional soldiers could not stand it. Like they just go, take him away. What's wrong with your shoes, soldier? I'm going, I don't know. All along, I've been sort of cultivating this antisocial personality. I'm not eating. I'm not socializing with anyone. I'm not refusing. You know, like if officers or anyone above me talks to me, I will say yes, no, you know, but I am not. And the other thing I was doing, I wasn't looking anyone in the eye.
What you were doing could have been interpreted as like this person's a bit of a prankster, but it came across as like this person is a bit unhinged and is a bit of a lost boy. I'm wondering, what's the difference?
Well, I don't know. That's a good it's a good question. What is the difference? I don't know. But one thing that kind of worked in my favor, 6 months before I went to army, someone actually went nuts and killed a whole, like a recruit went crazy, took a gun and like just shot a whole dorm. And so everyone was probably more on edge. A week in, a big general comes, like he sort of tours all these new recruits and gives them a pep talk and tells them what's how good it is to be in the army. And so I was going, I need to do something proper here. I need to really make an impact. So I decided to piss myself. And in order to do that, I didn't wee for about 24 hours. And so we're standing there. This guy is droning on and I was probably about, I don't know, 5 rows from the front and I was going, come on. And you would not believe how conditioned you are to wee in a toilet. I reckon 10 minutes it took me. I was going, come on, squeeze. And at the same time, busting, like absolutely busting. My God, the relief. When it actually started flowing, it was the best feeling in the world. Like literally going down in a rivulet down into the ground. And of course, like there's a commotion around me, you know, like there's people going, what was this? You know, like there's like a little wave and then people start laughing. Then like more people start laughing and more, and this guy's droning on. And then someone sort of runs up on stage and sort of whispers into this guy's ear and he just looked straight at me and went, take him away. After that, I was interviewed by a commanding officer of the whole camp. He was actually quite fatherly and he was very nice. And this is where I was going, I really don't want to leave. You need to let me stay. So what he did is he sent me to a psych assessment, like into the major city to a military hospital. I went out to the psych assessment, and the guy just looked at my file and went, I see 100 of you every day. What do you want? You're a fake. You are not sick. You are faking. You just want to get out of the fucking army. Get out of my office. Seriously, that was it. That was my psych assessment. And I went, oh, shit. That's it. I'm done. Walked out, waited for a while. A nurse comes out with an envelope and goes, here you go. So I'm carrying this envelope. And this envelope says, I am fit or I am not fit for army. So I went, fuck it, I'll just open it. And it just says, not fit for service. And I went, yes! I got out on the 11th day of me going in. I turned up home and my mum burst into tears. And my dad said, what did you do? What have you done? I was going, hey, I got papers.
Dean wasn't optimistic about the social and political future of Yugoslavia, so he decided to leave for Australia. He arrived in Sydney just days before his 21st birthday with $200 in his pocket.
So I rock up and there's this share house and we had a homosexual drug dealer up the top and he was like on the third floor, like there's people coming up and downstairs all the time. We had a Mill, the bikey. He had his motorbike in the kitchen sink, in bits. Like you walk into the house and there's a frame in that like a narrow hallway in a terrace house. And then you walk through to the kitchen, there's a one head, there's bits. And this is like we had to kind of work around that. We had a Bros fan from Canberra. She was at uni. She was like first year uni at Sydney Uni. And she would blast Bros, Duran Duran, like all that late 80s pop. And we had Sam, this chick that my friend was with, and me. I'm going, well, this is all very different than you. I'm coming from, you know, living with my mum and dad. We went to a party where people were huddled around the fire and were smoking pot and they ordered the pizzas and the pizzas had onions and pineapple on them. And I was just going, what is this shit? This is a travesty. And then I went home and I remember lying on this bare mattress on the floor. Like I had nothing, like zero. No, I had a bag of clothes, $200, that's it. And lying on this bare mattress in this bare, completely bare room and listening to the sirens. And I just went, can you hear that? That's Australia. That's awesome. Because of the war and also because I was an unemployed dead shit, I had no money to go back home. And so I actually ended up staying here for 7 years. When I went back, I didn't think it was going to be that emotional. And it wasn't until I left. I left after about 10 weeks and I got on a ferry from Croatia to Italy, like that's, and flew out from Rome, and I bawled for about 2 hours. Like it just caught me completely unawares. Like I said goodbye to everyone, and as we're pulling out of the harbour, and it is a very picturesque harbour, and it just smashed me like nothing has ever smashed me, like seeing my mum and dad and my sister sort of going into the distance, and it killed me. And like I really felt like I had this massive gap. In that gap, they were running in and out of shelters and being bombed and, you know, like all sorts of shit going on where, and I was on the dole in Sydney playing in a band. And so, you know, I felt a lot of guilt. I knew what I'm doing is the right thing, like right thing for me. That realization was also very difficult because I felt like I am abandoning my family. First time when I did it, kind of on a whim, and you know, like when you're young, you just go, fuck it, $200, that'll do, I'm out. But yeah, this time I felt the full gamut of feeling and responsibility. Thank you.
That story was by Alison Chan, with production assistance from Gregory J. Thorsby. You're listening to All the Best. I'm Samantha Gruff. All the Best is a show for new and emerging audio documentary makers to pitch, produce, and learn. If you pitch an awesome story idea to us, we'll also pair you with a supervising producer. Email us at contact@allthebestradio.com. We'd love to hear from you, genuinely. Devana Senanayake moved to Australia for university. As soon as she landed, though, she found out her time here wouldn't be quite what she expected. She spoke to three other immigrants about their first taste of the sunburnt country.
Immigration is as much about emotions as it is about geography. Like Odysseus in the epic The Odyssey, immigrants are constantly negotiating their sense of home and belonging. Immigrants take journeys for many reasons. I immigrated to Australia at the age of 18 from Colombo in Sri Lanka. I applied to the University of Melbourne and the University of Sydney through an education agency that helped me through the entire process. All this took up to 5 months. My mother made many sacrifices to send me to university in Australia. To come to Australia, my parents and I had to navigate an increasingly complex bureaucracy at home. This was the main problem. I spoke to three other immigrants to understand the complex and varied reasons they left their home. Helen Said and her parents immigrated to Australia to avoid persecution in their homeland of Egypt.
Yeah, my parents were part of a Greek minority living in Egypt. They lived in a suburb of Cairo called Heliopolis, which was a new part of Cairo. It had actually been built for the privileged Europeans. So my parents were born into a relative privilege, although they weren't rich by any means. They felt unsettled and uncomfortable. They were sometimes mistaken for being Jews and found themselves being chased and abused.
Though World War II had ended, Jews continued to be persecuted and ostracized.
My father dreamed of coming to Australia, but his mother didn't want him to leave, and she secretly threw his immigration applications forms into the rubbish bin. In the meantime, he got sick of waiting for a reply from the Australian authorities, which of course was never going to come, and my sister was born in Egypt. When my sister was a baby, another war was looming.
Britain and France had sent their forces in to teach Egypt's President Nasser a lesson. Earlier that summer, he had nationalised the Suez Canal, claiming its revenues for Egypt. But for the previous 74 years, this vital lifeline for oil supplies to Europe had been in British control. With its ally France, Britain decided on a military strike to get it back.
England, France and Israel attacked Egypt, I think with the aim of regaining the Suez Canal, because that was a big profit spinner in Egypt. When this happened, this put my parents into a lot of trouble because my dad was part Maltese and had inherited British citizenship, which he had passed also to my mother and to my older sister. My parents were put under house arrest and they were ordered to leave the country within 9 days.
Married and her family exited Sri Lanka to leave behind the country's racially charged atmosphere in the 1980s.
I originally came to Australia in 1990 by way of 10 years spent in England. My place of birth is Colombo, Sri Lanka. Became engaged to my husband, who so happened to be a Tamil, whilst I come from a Sinhalese background. So neither of our families approved of our association. And we had to bide our time so that eventually we had parental blessings and we got married in the way I always wanted to, in church with my father giving me away. We had a lovely wedding and then we had one son who was born in Sri Lanka. During this time, the troubles broke out between the Sinhalese and the Tamils and we were working in a district hospital. Things were getting tough because most of the staff were Sinhalese. I now had a Tamil surname, and my husband was a Tamil, so things were a little tight. And one day we were actually had to be rescued by my parents, who drove the 50 kilometers to get me and my husband to the safety of my parental home. During that time, we also heard that my husband's grandma's house was under threat from the Sinhalese mobs who were burning the Tamil homes. So we went on a rescue mission, my husband and I, and brought her to the safety of my parents' home. In the interim, we had to pass through a very violent Sinhalese racial mob. And being the only Sinhalese in the car, I had to talk my way out of a very tricky situation. That made us decide that it was difficult to stay on in Sri Lanka with the interracial marriage because neither of us were interested in racial politics. So we made the difficult decision that when we went to England to do our postgrad studies, that we would not come back to Sri Lanka again.
Unlike Helen and Mirin, Sabi's family moved to Australia for financial security.
Long months after the war's end, streets that once teemed with life and traffic lie stricken and dead.
After World War II, their home country, Germany, was struggling to recover. The economy was malfunctioning and the cities were piles of dilapidated infrastructure. They just could not make ends meet. So Sabi and her family moved to meet their father.
And my father didn't have very much to start off with. And it was very hard to get accommodation in Germany after the war because so much was bombed out. But they eventually got this small house with no water or electricity, and it was right in the middle of the forest. And my father was away most of the time trying to find work in the cities, and my mother was with two small children, her third having died from eating poisonous berries when we first moved into the forest, so that was a big family tragedy. And I remember my father was coming home with a paper that said, "Come to sunny Australia, the land of opportunity." And Australia, of course, needed workers, especially qualified workers. My mother was not very keen to go to Australia. Anyway, he persuaded her, and we didn't come as assisted migrants. My father had to spend years paying off our passage, but he was sponsored by an overseas construction company that was building houses in Bell Bay for the aluminium workers.
When it came time for me to move to Australia, my mother and I packed our bags full of pots, clothes for Melbourne's changing seasons, and spices in bulk. We carried files full of our documents just in case. The journey from Sri Lanka to Melbourne via stop at Singapore took 11 hours in total. In comparison to Helen, Mirin and Sabi's journey, I had a short transit. Transits last for years because people relocate several times before they set their roots in their desired destination. After leaving Egypt, Helen's family had to move through several countries before they even began their journey to Australia.
They were only allowed to take £5 out of the country, so they sold everything they had to raise the fares to fly. And at such short notice, they could only go to Britain, that because my dad was a British subject. So they left the country only with their wedding rings, the clothes they were wearing, two suitcases of clothes and five Egyptian pounds. They flew from Egypt to Rome and had to stay overnight. Well, in those days, my dad was a heavy smoker and he was desperate for a cigarette. And he went to a kiosk in Rome and he offered the man his £5. And the man at the kiosk handed him back his £5 and gave him a packet of cigarettes and said, "Look, the £5 is worthless here." And it was at that point that my dad realised that they were penniless refugees. They had no country, he had no income, he had no money, they had no possessions other than their clothes, the wedding rings, and worthless £5. They were given a place to stay overnight in Rome. And the next day, a plane flew them to Heathrow Airport and they got out of the plane in the middle of winter. And I was born 18 months after they arrived. My parents encountered quite a bit of racism and the weather was just unbearable for them. My dad always had his heart set on coming to Australia. Soon after they settled in England and after I was born, he again raised the subject of coming to Australia. And it took 2 years from the time he applied until the time that we left England. By then I was 4 years old. and much of the delay was because of the White Australia policy. You know, they investigate our ancestry, and my dad had to go to Somerset House where they have the records of births and so on, and he had to prove that five generations of the family were white.
Like Helen's family, Mirin and her husband moved to the UK and lived there before they made the collective decision to relocate to Australia. Sabi's family journeyed from Germany to Australia took a much longer time.
The first stop was at Aden, and that was a bit disconcerting because to all the Germans, they said Heil Hitler, which really put my mother in a most, you know, she was very perplexed by that, yeah. She had a gift for languages. She spoke French, German and English very well, and that sort of got her through on the boat, and she was kind of the de facto interpreter for the few other Germans that were on that boat.
Sabi and her family had to make do in cabins full of people, packed together like sardines in a tin.
We had this really overcrowded little cabin way down in the dungeons. When we got there, there were 10 people trying to get it, and I think it might have had a sink in the room. And there was an Italian woman with two of her children, and there was this elderly Serbian lady who seemed to cry most of the time. So my sister and I used to go early to eat, and every day it was pasta, and occasionally at the end we'd get some fruit, and if we were lucky, some gelati. I love pasta now, but then I was so sick of it after 4 weeks on the ship. The most memorable event was Christmas. The Germans were trying to sing some, you know, Christmas songs and light candles and have a bit more of a reverential ceremonial thing, but it didn't really work because the Italians then took the Christmas tree and danced around.
Like Sabi, Helen's family journeyed from England to Australia on a ship.
So it stopped in Perth, and that must have been Anzac Day 1962. All of the shops were shut. My dad went ashore and he had a look around. And of course, being a public holiday, all the shops were shut. The streets were deserted, and he saw a wanted poster of an escaped criminal. And my dad thought, this country, Australia, it's like the Wild West.
When I arrived, I expected Australia to be a place full of sunny beaches, green cities and chilled out surfers. Once my mother and I arrived in Australia, I remember two lines, one for visitors from Australia, New Zealand, UK and the US, and another line for visitors from other countries. Standing before the visa official, I remembered feeling incredibly anxious. Thankfully, he stamped my passport and I went in. The 11-hour flight and the immense jet lag caught up to me, and I cried as I stepped out onto a burning 35-degree summer day. Helen describes her father's response, seeing his family gathered.
The ship pulled into Station Pier, and he had a movie camera which he'd bought en route, and it had a zoom lens. And through the zoom lens, he was able to pick out all of our relatives. My mum's sister's family, my dad's brother's family were all waiting for us on Station Pier, and they split us into different cars. They all had, you know, small cars, and took us back to my auntie's house, and that's where we stayed for the first 6 months in Australia.
Once Sabi's mother caught a glimpse of the buildings on the shore, she changed her opinion about Australia. It had not turned out to be as desolate or as bleak as she had expected.
In Melbourne, where my father met us, it took some finding amongst the hundreds and hundreds of other people waiting to pick up their relatives off the boat. And this sea of humanity all waving and, you know, wondering which of those was our father.
Sabi's family met their father in Melbourne. The family then journeyed together to Tasmania. The immigrant that takes a journey to another land is never the same person that started it. Once a journey is complete, the apprehension, dislocation and disconnection born out of the journey do not end there. Like luggage, they are unconsciously carried past the port. Then there are other doors that have to be opened to actually set root in a country and settle there. And this is the start of another journey.
Thank you.
That story was by Devana Senanayake. Sound design and original composition by Riley McCullough. The supervising producers were Selena Shannon and Alison Chan. Additional thanks goes to Layla Caridi of Multicultural Arts Victoria and 3CR in Melbourne. This episode of All the Best was compiled and mixed by Alina Godwin with Sarah O'Malley. All the Best would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the lands on which we make these stories and pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. All the Best is made at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with SYN and 3RRR in Melbourne. Our executive producer is Alison Chan. Our Victorian State Coordinator is Jordan Fennell. Our brand new SYN Community Coordinator is Erin Dick. Our Community Coordinator is Chloe Gillespie. Matilda Fay is our social media producer. And I'm your host, Samantha Groth. Shining Bird composed our theme music and Annie Hamilton designed the artwork. All the Best is heard across Australia on the Community Radio Network and is made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter and find all of our other episodes at allthebestradio.com. We're also a podcast, so subscribe. And you can listen to us every time you're eating a Hawaiian pizza. While you're listening, give us a review in your favourite podcast app.